Welcome to the next episode of the Haskell Interlude, where we'll talk to Oscar Wikström. So Oscar will tell us a little bit about property-based testing Haskell code, but also applying these ideas to the testing of complete systems. He'll say a little bit about interfacing Haskell to other languages and even your web browser, and what it's like to learn Rust as a Haskell programmer. So welcome to the next episode of the Haskell Interlude. I'm Wouter Schwierstra, and with me today is...
Alejandro.
Hi, Alejandro. And our guest is Oscar Wikström. And Oscar is an independent contractor working on the Wikström project. Hi, Oscar.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get into Haskell?
Yes. Well, this was maybe 10 years ago or something. It was quite early in my programming journey or career when I was probably first introduced to Scala by someone who was like my mentor very early on. Mm-hmm. But rather quickly that turned into looking into Haskell on my own. And since then, I've been sort of intertwined with Haskell in one or more ways, I guess. But yeah, in the beginning, it was mostly just playful stuff and my personal interest in it. Yeah.
So how did you drift from Scala to Haskell? What kind of project were you working on?
So yeah, in the beginning there, it was just my personal explorations. And it was mostly just like the curiosity around FP. And let's see, what was the first actual kind of project? It was probably something with some web server related thing. I remember I was very interested in like the REST pattern and see if I could do something like that in Haskell. I had this trying to do like very practical things with Haskell, so to speak. I saw also that there was sort of the area of web technology was sort of, well, somewhat explored in Haskell, but not all of what I was interested in. Yeah.
I think by that time was where there was like this explosion of web frameworks. Like you suddenly had nothing, and next day you had like Yeesod and the Scotty, and I think Servant was not there yet, but people were exploring this area. So I think it was
because
now it feels like Haskell is a very backend language. So I think people approach it that way, but it wasn't until recently that we had all these nice web frameworks.
Right. Yeah. There was this other framework that I got really interested in, which I think it sort of died off, but it was based on the web machine architecture from the Erlang project. I think that is called web machine, but more like the structure more centered around resources, so to speak, than just handlers on paths in a web server. So I can't remember the name. It was something with air something. Yeah, it was a few years ago now. Anyway, so that was an interest, and I started there and picked up more and more for practical things and started using it in some work projects. I was that annoying guy that picked up Haskell so that everyone else had to also learn a bit of Haskell, I guess. But there came this need for a compiler-like tool that we used in a project. So that was a fun start, and it obviously fits quite well to use Haskell for that. So that was probably the first like actual work project with Haskell.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then one thing you did is you got into property-based testing, I think, right? Which is like many people are familiar with libraries like QuickCheck or SmallCheck, where you specify some kind of property that you expect for your functions to hold, and then you either generate inputs for that function and try to falsify this. And then you wrote a small book about property-based testing a real application. So usually when you see a quick check tutorial, there's always these very clean examples of checking whether an insert on a binary tree works or a search tree works. But you wrote something about property-based testing a screencast editor, which is, I think, an unusual kind of domain to think of property-based testing. So what drove you to that project?
Yeah, that is like the largest rabbit hole I've ever been down in, I think. And so this started with, let's rewind a bit. I started doing Haskell videos first, like screencasts, producing screencasts. And they were called Haskell at Work. That was also very like focus on the practical side of using Haskell for whatever work projects and stuff like that. And so I started exploring, like, how do you edit a screencast? Like, how do you record it? How do you plan, or like plan it, record it, and then edit? And I don't know, it's painful. It's a lot of work. And the sort of mainstream or traditional, I think it's called non-linear video editors from the sort of the legacy of video editing back when they had more like tapes rather than files on a disk. But the whole idea around that is very different from how I would like to think about sections or scenes or this structure of the screencast that I'm producing. And also, I found that, like, I was rather picky with, like, audio quality and recording and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to have, like, keyboard noise, and I didn't want to, I wanted to be, like, really, really snappy. And yeah. I recorded all the video separately from the audio, and I planned everything, like, down to the word, basically. So yeah. I had a detailed script, and I recorded all the voice stuff separately, and then I joined it together. And that process of joining it together was really painful in the traditional editor. And like, oh, I got to move this 500 milliseconds or like 100 milliseconds to sound a bit more natural with the typing. And, you know, so I started on, this was probably a mistake, but I started building a video editor for the screencasts, for the production of these screencasts. And it basically sliced up all the inputs automatically based on movement in video and based on the patterns in the audio,
right?
Like silence. And then I had this kind of Vim-like editor workflow where I could just grab pieces of audio and video and put them together and add gaps, they were called, and you can sort of quickly process the inputs to assemble the video. And this was rather fiddly to build the editor. And had lots of complicated logic around the editing and not only the editing, the Vim-like thing, but also the processing of audio and video.
Yeah. So this was built with Haskell, all this editor?
Yeah, this is written in Haskell. It definitely doesn't compile anymore. I've tried, but like, it's a mess. We can maybe talk about that later. I think I've started writing this around 2017, 18, something like that. And it started with just trying to figure out, this is actually a recurring theme in my use of Haskell. It's just writing down some data structures and messing around with something to figure out, like, the what are the sort of edges of this problem, or how can things fit together. Maybe write a few tests or something.
The data modeling, right? Where you want to figure out just the right data structures to that are well-behaved, that support the operations that you're looking for, and so forth.
See if you can, like, find this nice algebraic structure that works for your problem or not. So it started like that, and it was sort of just unfolded to a full video editor with a lot of time. But the complicated thing might have been the GTK UI bits too. Well, we can maybe go that direction later. But anyway, so this editor, I started exploring property-based testing. That's where we started.
Yeah.
Sort of a roundabout way of getting there. But this was a new technique to me. And I had looked at property-based testing before, and I'd been to some talks and seen all those examples that you mentioned, the list reversing, and I couldn't figure anything out. Maybe there is this threshold of understanding it. That is, it takes some time and it takes some effort. And I don't know if what is the best way to teach property-based testing. I really don't know.
One of the things which I like about QuickCheck is that it originated as something to help mark students' homework assignments, right? Where they would think about what are the tests that we can write. And if, you know, you can think about six properties of reversing lists or something, and then if it passes all these, then it's pretty hard to write a function which passes all these things but doesn't reverse a list, right? So that, and I don't know, right? It's hard because a lot of the time people think of writing tests as writing unit tests, right? Where they say, oh, I just want to check that, you know, this certain control flow or this series of steps, I set up something and I make these calls and I check that I get a result back. And if I throw in some bogus data, I check that I get an error back. And then you come up with three edge cases and so forth. I think one way that I think about this property-based testing is that what you're doing is you're kind of automating unit testing in a way, right? That you don't have to write the unit test yourself, but you abstract over this and you write a program which writes unit tests for you. So that when you call that program, it generates inputs and then it checks that each of the unit tests passes the way you would expect.
That's already quite nice, but it gives you a bit more understanding of the program. Just being able to, like, I don't know, I usually approach as you write one unit test and then you try to prune it to say, okay, what are the things which I don't really care or what things could be generated arbitrarily? And I don't know, it at the end of the day, it gives you a bit of the idea of what your program is doing. You can always fall on the trap of just re-implementing your function.
Yeah.
So I think what's hard though is that for a lot of property-based testing, the examples, like you say, they tend to be quite small functions. Whereas if you have, I know I spent some time in the industry and then we would write unit tests to, you know, test the integration of a whole bunch of subsystems. And then you really just wanted to check that the whole thing didn't fall down out of a sudden. And if you kind of explain that, and then if that's what you're used to when it comes to testing, just to, you know, check that I could pass in some inputs and then get the answer that I want, whether it's like setting up some, you know, suppose you're testing a web server, you just make a few calls to check that you get the behavior that you're expecting, right? But you don't typically think in terms of, so what's the specification of this web server and what's the behavior that I expect that it satisfies? And that, taking that, making that generalization step, right? From here's a unit test that checks that the system doesn't fall down to here's the specification of what the system should really be doing, and let's check that instead, right?
I mean, it seems like this is a common thing for all knowledge and learning, that you learn by example a lot. And maybe some people can learn abstractions quicker than others or something like that. But it's sort of, you gather examples, you gather concrete things, and then you can maybe abstract from there once you've gotten comfortable with all those examples.
I was saying, talking about examples, I mean, I'm curious, what are the kind of properties that you were testing for the screencast editor?
Oh, yeah. I don't recall all of them like that. But see, we had the Vim-like editor things. They were pretty simple to understand properties, I think. Like, if you did a bunch of actions and then you undid all of the actions, you would end up where you started, stuff like that. Or if you, there were variations on that, but redoing all the actions after undoing all the actions, then you're back at where you ended up before you started.
It's nice that, because I've also read it sometimes, you know, that this idea of using QuickCheck to generate not examples but actual traces of execution and then checking stuff, I've heard it a couple of times, and it seems like such a great technique to me. Like, you know, you go one step high. You're actually creating traces of what the user could do and then checking properties over those, which I think goes, you know, when I learned QuickCheck, I was always think of this simple function and reverse. But the idea that you can have a trace, I don't know. I've seen it several times, and I think it's such a great technique that people should know, because it works very much. And, you know, people in Hexel are already used to having free monads and all these kind of things. So it fits naturally that you could actually also test those things if you want to.
Right. Yeah. So in QuickCheck and in many other property-based testing libraries now, you have some sort of state machine testing support. There's usually something for it where you can, it's not exactly what I used, but it's reminiscent of the same thing. So with those state machine testing approaches, you basically have a model and you have your actual implementation, and your model is just a simplified version of that implementation, ideally. And you sort of step them forward in lockstep and see if they match in what you can observe. But in my case, it was easier than that, because I didn't need to have a model. I didn't have to implement the screencast editor twice in a simpler way, I could just say that as long as I can see the end state of a sequence of actions, I can or like apply actions and observe some end state. I just want to see this property that, you know, undoing the same number of actions as I initially did would end up in the initial state. And I don't need to have a model. But it's the same sort of idea of using properties on traces or on stateful systems or on sort of step behaviors like that. Yeah. So I found this very, very useful when I did those editor actions, because these simple properties like undo and redo, they helped fix bugs in all the other actions that were possible. So I had actions like the video was like a hierarchical structure. So you can have sequences of sequences of sequences. And in there you had like audio and video bunch fit together somehow. And you can sort of join and split those or do these operations on them. Sort of like if you're familiar with paredit for Emacs or Lisps, if you have a Lisp.
Where you have parentheses and it sort of respects the structure, right?
Exactly. You can transform the structure of the parentheses, like join two different expressions into one, or like remove the intermediate parens, or like lift and lower stuff. So it's the same idea, really, that you can apply these transformations to this structure without, you know, breaking it. And I could find bugs in like basically all of these operations by just doing the undo redo thing. So it was really effective. And the other property I can mention was the video processing. The audio processing was quite simple because I found a library that could split audio based on silence. But the video thing I built from scratch, basically. And let's see, I did some fun stuff there. How did it work? Well, I think I actually generated output that I know how. So let's go back. There was a component called a classifier, I think, which took video and said, like, this is a scene, and then this is a scene, and then this is a scene. So it just basically you get intervals of time, like a list of intervals or something like that. So to test that, I had this property that generated output from which I knew where it would classify the scenes, like which were, I could like generate just a list of intervals, right? And then I could sort of transform those to video that matched, that would trigger scene changes. And then I would run the classifier and check that it gave me back the same list of intervals, basically. So this sort of reverse thinking of generating the expected output, and then running the program and seeing that you get the right output. That was, for me, that was a revelation, that something I would never have thought if I were doing a unit testing. That's like such a mindset shift. The book is about these examples more in detail. So it is pretty short. Yeah, it was a really fun project. I still do a lot of PBT, like in my work. I used to bring it in work projects and my spare time stuff too.
Is it easy to bring it into, you know, your projects? I'm curious how people react to, you know, changing people think of unit tests, integration tests, and that's it. And this new thing might be frightening somehow.
Yeah, somewhat. It's a bit of a struggle to get it integrated in a team. And like most people are curious and they can really see the value. But as you say, it's like this new, big, different thing. And when they fail, if they find something, then it's maybe not everyone wants to go in and fix them. And this is a fun thing with property tests too, because if they might not expose a bug on every run, right? So we've had stuff like a lot of the stuff I've been doing the last few years in work projects have been, or in the work project I've been at, has been dealing with stuff around time zones and time a lot. And some bugs have like shown up 3 months later in CI, where it's like, if you're in this particular time zone with these particular fiddly details, then you have this daylight savings time switch happening at the right moment. So like, it's a mess.
But times are a mess. Yeah.
Yeah. But they have found like actual bugs that no one would ever find even for like running these all over every commit. So you can argue, like, is that time zone bug really that important? Like, yeah, maybe not, but...
I mean, I know people at Standard Chartered, right? And they have to, using Haskell, and they have a lot of headaches with, you know, you have to calculate interest payouts, right? But then if there's a bank holiday in England, or if, I don't know, it's the Queen's Jubilee on a full moon or who knows what, right? Then this extra clause kicks in, and this is just a nightmare to model this accurately.
This might be the reason why my bank has set my interest rate to zero. That's an easy calculation.
That's the property. It has to end up at zero. but that sort of reminds me of a thing that I've found with property-based testing. I don't know what your experiences are here, but if you model something like the thing you mentioned with the bank and all mm-hmm. these business rules and stuff, you can end up in this situation where the property is, so there's so much essential complexity around this problem. So your tests or your models or your oracles, whatever, they are basically as complicated as the thing you're testing. And mm-hmm. it's so hard in that situation to sort of back out of that complexity and find a simple property yeah. or find something that where you can test it without sort of duplicating the whole system.
Yeah. Now, especially if you have many of these edge cases that you have to account for in the spec, right? Then all of a sudden it's getting the specification right is as hard as getting the code right almost, right?
And you have to fiddle with generators and stuff to trigger these edge cases, but not too often because it's unproductive. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So then on the topic of property-based testing, I guess, one of the things you're involved in heavily at the moment is this Quickstrom project. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it sort of sprung out of the property-based testing interest of mine. And I think this was around the time our son was born, and my mind was like everywhere, and lots of sleep deprivation and stuff. And somehow this turned it into a productive thing too. I don't know how, I had these small hacking sessions and thinking sessions in the middle of the night. It's like, oh, I have an hour where I can be alone for a little moment. So I started thinking a lot about, well, I read the TLA Plus book, the first bit of it, the one by Leslie Danforth, was called mm-hmm. Specifying Systems. And I was looking a lot at TLA Plus from different angles, also Lil Wayne's online resources. And I was really interested and inspired by this temporal logic approach of specification, basically, but also in the sort of practical application of property-based testing on actual programs, like the sort of black box testing style, or just the regular artifacts that you would run in the end. So I haven't really used TLA Plus for anything real, or I messed around with it, and I messed around with Alloy a bit. Still, I haven't really like used it at work or used it for some interesting problem, which isn't just, you know, copy pasting something from the internet. So, but I had this interest in temporal logic, and I saw some connection to the state machine testing that we discussed before. Like,
so
maybe
just to have all like the same ground. So when you say temporal logic, how is it that different from like regular logic?
Oh yeah. Okay. So temporal logic, or specifically the kind of logic that I'm using, is linear temporal logic. And so in a regular, like what's called propositional logic, you have the operators that most people are probably familiar with, like or and implication, and you have these atoms or atomics usually. And then there is like what's the next one,
where you predicate have logic.
Temporal predicate logic. Yeah. I forget these names all the time.
Yeah. Don't worry. Somebody might be teaching a logic course right now. So that's
right. Somewhere on earth. Yeah. I'm not formally trained in these things. They're not like really haven't stuck that well. But anyway, so in linear temporal logic, you have back in propositional logic, you have all these operators and so on, but you're sort of expressing something stateless. It's just this global state that you can say something about, whether something is true or false. with temporal logic and linear temporal logic, you can talk about time, how something changes over time, or how the truth of something changes over time. So you can basically say something like, X is 1, and in the next state, X is 2. Or you can, so in that case, the next part is an operator. So if I would try to formulate that a bit more structurally, it would be like X equals 1 and parentheses next X equals 2 or something like that.
Right. So adds a layer to the logic to talk about like steps or passing of time or something like this. Okay. Then now the name makes sense.
I'm not sure if the temporal operators are like a modality. This is sort of outside my expertise, I guess, but it feels like that to me. Like you take a formula and you sort of say that if you have the next operator and some expression or some formula that changes how that formula is interpreted, then that formula is interpreted in the next state instead. So basically, you have these operators to talk about how things change over time. You have next, but you also have always, which says that, you know, always X equals 1, that means that X is always equals 1, if that is true. Or you can say that X is eventually true, so eventually X equals 1. There are a bunch of others, but
yeah.
Now that you have these temporal operators, you can sort of specify how a system evolves over time, or you can start specifying state machines, basically. So this ties back to what we talked before with property-based testing and state machine testing. So instead of having a model that sort of replicates the actual system under test in a simplified manner, ideally, you could instead have this temporal logic formula that specifies the system without perhaps being a full implementation or a full model of that system. That was sort of what I realized, how temporal logic could fit together with property-based testing for stateful systems.
And that led to Quickstrom, right? So yeah. But Quickstrom is, if I understand correctly, it's a way to do property-based testing, but for, say, front-end web applications or JavaScript code, right? Where you typically want to trigger a bunch of events mimicking what a user might do in a web browser, and then observe whether the specification given now, instead of kind of usually we think of specifications in quick check or small check or any of these property-based testing languages, this is somehow being a predicate, right? Saying that run the function and then check that that the output satisfies this predicate. But here you don't have a single predicate, but you have one of these more advanced formulas that want to check that as you kind of throw new events at the system, some invariant holds, or eventually something good happens, something like that. Is that fair?
Yeah, exactly. So that is sort of the third leg of Quickstrom, is the web, or at least the first version of Quickstrom, how it started. So it is this kind of property-based testing approach together with specifying in temporal logic, but also in your specifications, you also specify or you sort of declare actions. And so you can say stuff like, click buttons that match the selector in the browser. So you have CSS selectors to specify what can be done or what is sort of allowed to be done. And if we look a bit more at like how it works in detail, when it runs a check, it constantly communicates with the browser or introspects the browser to see what is the state. Mm-hmm. And the actions that are declared are sort of matched with that state to see like, okay, maybe only two of these actions are actually possible at this particular state. And then it randomly selects one of those and progresses, and then you have a new state and you can evaluate from there. And when it's doing this exploration of the web app, it collects all the states, and then it can use the temporal logic formula to, as you said, as a predicate on that sequence of states.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that this reminds me a bit of what model checking people are doing, sort of also exploring the state of a model. So is there any relation between like what model checking people are doing and this approach you have to property-based testing with temporal logic?
Yeah, I think there is. Again, I'm sort of a novice when it comes to model checking, but it seems like model checking is about, to some, if not fully exhaustively, then at least to up to some point, exploring as much of the state space that you can, really. So this doesn't come near a model checker when it comes to like how much of the state space it can check or explore, because browser testing is pretty slow. So it really is more like property-based testing in that sense, that you have a very, or not necessarily a very limited, but a more limited exploration of the state space, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Can you do anything to speed up it? Because I can imagine that you don't want to, I don't know, parse the DOM after every state change, or that you might want to recognize when you're in a state that you've seen previously, or I don't know. I can imagine that there are a lot of opportunities to be clever, but maybe none of these are optimizations. I don't know. Is there anything you can say about that?
Yeah, definitely. Like, the first thing I realized pretty quickly was that you can't collect all of the state of the browser into the checker. And then it's like, yeah, I'm only going to look at these two, you know, these two elements or these properties. There is a static analysis pass of the spec, which mm-hmm. sort of collects these are all the possibly interesting things.
Yeah.
So you don't have to query for everything, because it wouldn't be feasible to do. That is one thing. On the speed aspect, yeah, looking at stuff like cycles and so on, there is a lot more work to be done. And I also have, like, I started doing this as a sort of prototype or a first version, and it was based on, or it is based on PureScript. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've partnered up with Liam O'Connor, and we're doing this as a more, we're doing a new version. And he's an academic and has more experience looking at temporal logic from a more like formal way. We basically redesigned the temporal logic that we use, and we have a new version. It's not released yet, and something we're working on still, but it has a bunch of tricks going on that makes stuff a bit faster. Especially one thing I realized in my first version, I couldn't, if the spec would, you know, reject some sequence of actions early on, like if there were like four actions in, and then it would be impossible for it to be true. It couldn't really stop there, because it didn't evaluate the spec like at each step. So it would collect a full trace, and then was like, ah, no, you failed at step four.
Yeah.
So that was sort of silly, but it's pretty hard when you start looking at this, how to do that. And other stuff we have talked about doing, and we have some ideas around, are basically around exploring the state space more efficiently or more intelligently than just doing random stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you have, let's say you have a website and you have a bunch of just information pages or whatever, and then you have some functionality somewhere that is interesting to test, but you might want to every now and then go through the information pages to check that they're not fully broken. It would be a waste of time to just bounce around information pages forever in all your testing. So you might want to like direct it somehow, or have a more guided testing, so to speak. So we have some ideas on how to do that and improve.
Is that a bit like an imperfect analogy, maybe, is to think of writing good generators for quick check tests, where you typically want to make sure that you get good coverage of
which
represents real data, right? The same might be here, where you want to, of course, if you're, I don't know, suppose you're building some online web shop, right? Then the crucial bits are, you know, checking credit card information and collecting that, and not shipping stuff until it's been paid. But at the same time, you do want to kind of simulate what a real user might do, is, you know, click around to find a bunch of products before selecting the ones that they want to buy. So you want to somehow weigh probabilistically, get the right coverage and not spend all of your time clicking around, filling your shopping basket while still making sure that you're not always buying the one product, the same product all the time.
Right. Yeah. The analogy to generators is spot on. I mean, in Quickstorm, you don't write generators as such, like you don't have access to it, you could say. But that would be like, because it sort of generates based on the state of the web app at each step. But that is the selection of actions based on, like, if you know that these are the selectable actions, which one is selected, that is sort of the analogy to the generators.
Yeah. So you mentioned that this new implementation is not going to be in Haskell, but you've actually moved to Rust, I think. So can you say something about what triggered the transition there?
Right. So first, we realized that this Quickstream implementation, the new one, is actually two programs. I'll just say a short bit about that. But we realized like the web specifics in Quickstream aren't really tied to anything else. And we sort of split the implementation into one checking engine, the thing that parses the specifications and that drives the checking. Yep. And then it communicates with another component, which does the sort of web specifics of talking to a browser.
Yeah.
And executing actions and so on. And you could swap that out for something else. You could write an implementation that, you know, talks to another kind of GUI, or we have had wild ideas, but basically any stateful system that you can trigger actions in and that you can observe state from. Those are sort of the two big operations. And the checker, we started building that in Haskell, and we had a prototype which worked nicely and was very quick to get up and running, but we also found that we had some problems with space leaks. At some point we were like, we're gonna try doing this in Rust. We've had good experiences so far, but space leaks is something that I've struggled a bit with in the video editor, for instance, and
So these space leaks, they presumably come from that you must have long traces, and then you're collecting data, and then you would evaluate this, and then somehow, if you're not strict enough, these thunks, they just grow bigger and bigger and bigger until they're kind of fully evaluated at some point, and then finally they collapse.
And I mean, in the specification language, that is sort of a functional programming kind of logic language, and it has laziness, so there are thunks in that language too.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's hard to like invalidate those.
Okay. Then that becomes pretty hard to debug at some point, I can imagine. Yeah. If you have what you might describe as the ambient laziness that Haskell supports, and then the kind of laziness of the system that you're building, or the DSL or the specification language, and then getting these two to interact well and then not running into space leaks, that I can see that can be pretty tricky.
That was one thing. I mean, we would have the problem of space leaks in our language, in the interpretation of that language, if we wrote an interpreter in Rust too. Like some of it is sort of an essential complexity of that language that. But then you have Haskell's own sort of space leak problem. So we decided to do it differently. And we also were a bit burned on dependencies and churn with versions and so on in Haskell. So as I mentioned before, like I have no chance of compiling my project from 2018. It's a bit, bit annoying. I can see the pros and cons of having it that way. Like if you pick up a Java project from like 2006, it would probably be compiled today, like without much work. But they have like this really strict, culture or mindset around dependencies and compatibility. And Haskell doesn't. And that has, it makes it easier to progress and go beyond these old annoying problems that we've had for some time. But it also has some costs. So
yeah.
I'm wondering, because when I read about Rust, 99% of the stuff is clearly geared toward C, C++ programmers to show how Rust is much better. But of course, when I approach it from the Haskell point of view, for me, it's mostly an annoyance that I have to fight the borrow checker. So I shouldn't be doing this, because I'm the first who says that you are not fighting the type system, but somehow I feel I'm fighting the borrow checker. So I was wondering, how's your experience from moving from Haskell to Rust, and how much time did it take to be productive? Because that's maybe I'm just spending too little, and you know, in 1 month I would actually get it.
Yeah, I haven't done that much Rust yet, so I'm very new to this. But I guess I've been sort of taking the shortcuts as much as possible and not fight the borrow checker if I can avoid it. In some instances, like I tried to do the thing that I would have done in Haskell, and it would be super painful. And like I would have to pass lifetimes all over the place, and like 500 lifetime parameters on every data structure. And yeah, no, maybe not worth it. And then you like put a box around something, and it sort of works.
Yeah,
that's already good to know that if you go the easy route, you're gonna still get something which doesn't have a space leaks. So
yeah, hopefully not. Yeah. And also, like, it's been a very nice experience with tooling and so on.
Yeah.
So far, so
since you mentioned space leaks, and I think that's already something which it's hard. We don't have a lot of tools, and I think also for people who are starting with Haskell, they, you know, suddenly everything is cool and nice, and then you have a space leaks, and then they are hard to debug and hard to find. So I don't know whether you have, you know, an opinion or ideas of how we could approach this problem. You know, how do you think we could avoid this or have more introspection of what's going on in our programs?
Yeah, I don't think I have any very good answers to this problem. I can just like vaguely say that it would be nice to have better introspection and tooling of some sort, but I'm not sure how it would look.
Having said all of this, there's a lot to be said for laziness, right? I think there's a... One thing I like about Haskell is when you prototype something is that I don't have to worry about evaluation order, right? I can just write it out and I know that it'll all be taken care of and I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's only when I want to get a certain level of performance or predictable memory usage that I then have to start to become very careful about where to put certain bangs and what gets evaluated when, and to make sure that I be just strict enough in the right places. And that's when I teach students Haskell, or when it's a particular mindset or a particular skill set, which is very hard to teach or to pick up, right? It requires certain insight about how GHC works. And there's a lot of stuff out there which can really help, right? Sometimes generating these profiles and all of this. But yeah, that tells you part of the story. But before you really see, like, where is the space leak coming from, or what's not being forced, or why is something being shared or not being shared? And you need to have a pretty deep understanding, I think, of what lazy evaluation is doing.
Yeah. I found myself annoyingly like middle ground in this question somehow. Like I tried being on the extreme ends of this, let's say, debate, if laziness is good or bad or whatever. But so like Haskell is often shown with these cute, nice examples of like, if you use laziness, you can do this. It's so amazing. Yeah, that looks cool. And maybe it's useful in some particular case, but I never like use those things. I never really like leverage that power in such a clear way. But then if I would adopt the other way of like, maybe everything should be strict. I don't know. Let's try having everything strict. And then I get stuck on all kinds of problems instead with the strict evaluation.
Yeah.
And like if I'm in PureScript or something and I still have this sort of Haskell mindset going, then I might get bitten on strictness somehow. So yeah, I find myself sort of in the middle there all the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, I've been lately writing some Kotlin for work, and I'm so used to doing things in Haskell, like I map and then find. And then I know that once I find the first thing which has been mapped, nothing else happens. And suddenly I write this in a strict language. And why are you mapping over my whole list? I only need to find one element. So it. And I have the feeling that some idioms, it's more like I don't use laziness. It's more that I use some idioms which use laziness somehow. Like, you know, when you use and then or, and it's lazy and or searchable and whatever you do it, and you don't really think about it. It's just you just write and whatever the language. So for me, that's been the hardest to move for. So Because other than that, most of the times you really want all your arguments to be evaluated, because, well, that's why they are there at the end of the day.
Right. I did stumble upon like one of these things where laziness is really not just a nice trick, but sort of an essential thing. And it was in the first Quickstream interpreter based, which uses PureScript as sort of the surface language. When you have like recursive bindings, you have to like build up this recursive environment basically. And yeah. Then, but that was like using Monad fix, but you need the laziness in that case. So
yeah.
And it's such a mind bender. I have no like, and no goal of really understanding, like to the core understanding and embodying the full understanding of Monad fix and that kind of recursion in my life ever. But I'm accepting that.
Yeah,
something that is good. Yeah.
Oh, maybe changing a bit of a different topic, but I'm always impressed about how it seems in every project you do, you somehow manage to interface with the rest of the world. You do the thing and then quick. For me, it's really interesting that Quickstream talks to the browser, or that, you know, you build this editor and you actually like build like a special version of GTK, this declarative version of GTK, right? So, because I think that's a corner we don't look at very often, interfacing Haskell with other languages. So I was wondering how was your experience there, you know, not writing just Haskell, pure Haskell, but really talking to other things.
Yeah, I mean, the library situation in Haskell might not always be like perfect with stuff like GTK and so on. It's maybe not super well used and pretty, in some cases, very bare bones stuff. So like in Quickstream, when talking to the browser, you need some kind of web driver implementation, and they are maybe not exactly as, you know, up to the full feature set of current web driver specification or whatever. So it is, you might have to build some stuff on your own. And I don't know, it's in the early phases of a project where Haskell really shines on like prototyping something or getting something consistent or like well behaved together, I find that it's often acceptable to have these more immature libraries, so to speak. Yeah, and the same with the GTK. Like, it would probably be easy to write regular GTK code with the Python implementation or whatever. I don't know. I've so far been enough interested in Haskell and doing sort of the core logic in Haskell to take that cost, I guess. But there definitely is a cost, because libraries are very often not the same quality as in mainstream languages.
And setting up the whole FFI and marshalling data and all of this is still not easy. I mean, there's some tool support, but it's still like a significant cost, right? I mean, that's at least my experience whenever I tried to, people try to do things like write, I don't know, iOS apps using Haskell or something, right? And then you need to talk to a zillion, it used to be Objective-C, nowadays it's Swift, right? Libraries, yeah. And then figure out how to call something and then make sure everything is garbage collected at the right point and convert data back and forth. And then at some point, the overhead to doing that kind of programming is so much bigger than the potential gain that using Haskell has to offer.
Right. Maybe that's where Haskell starts to find its niche, or a few niches, I guess, where, like, if, for example, if you're doing backend services or like web servers or APIs or something like that, it's easier to interface with stuff, because there's always already this, I don't know, culture around having a few ways of communicating between services with like protobufs or JSON or whatever. Yeah. And it's sort of easier to interface. But if you're going into a desktop GUI programming, then it's pain.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's maybe the success of the Haskell web servers that we talked about, right? It's much easier if, you know, it doesn't matter. Kind of, you just get some JSON requests thrown at you and then you respond appropriately, and you don't have to go around all of this interfacing and setting stuff up.
Yeah.
Okay. Any parting thoughts, Oscar?
Not more than it's been really nice to talk to you.
Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Thanks. I really enjoyed that. I learned a lot. It's always nice to see property-based testing and see Haskell used in practice in a bunch of domains, and also kind of broaden the horizon of thinking about applying these ideas in settings I would not expect to encounter, right? It's been a lot of fun.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.